Writer Michael Connelly is a fan of jazz, as is one of Connelly's characters, Detective Hieronymus Harry Bosch. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Michael Connelly is our guest in this portion of the program. The occasion for our conversation, the publication of his latest book, Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers. The book is a collection of crime stories Connelly wrote in the 1980s and 1990s. Before he became a fiction writer, Michael Connelly was a reporter working the police beat, and those days spent covering cops, criminals, and their victims inspired the characters of his novels, characters like Harry Bosch. In this new book, Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers, Connelly revisits his first career and shares with us some very fine journalism. The police beat provided Connelly with a solid foundation for a novelist. The Washington Post has described Connelly as, quote, the real thing, taking us into parts of the real America that most of our novelists never visit because they don't even know where or what they are. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. You can join the conversation with a telephone call. Questions about journalism, crime stories, fiction, all are invited. If you'd like to talk with Michael Connelly, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Michael Connelly is the author of 16 novels and this collection of true crime stories, Crime Beat. His most recent novel is The Lincoln Lawyer. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Michael Connelly joins us by phone this afternoon from Florida. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
What's the weather there like at the moment?
It's feeling pretty lucky.
Yeah.
At least where I'm living in Tampa, it kind of skirted by here, and we didn't have too much of a problem. Just had kind of a night where we were up a lot because of all the wind and noise.
Yeah, well, knock on wood, it seems like it's not going to be a hurricane, and the worst is over.
Yeah.
You open this new book, Crime Beat, with a story about how it was your interest in crime and writing began. Would you share it with our listeners this afternoon?
That's the story about me, you mean?
Yeah.
I guess anyone, whatever they do in their life, they can kind of trace back to maybe where the seeds of that were planted. And for me, it was strictly happenstance. One night I was driving home from a nighttime job I had washing dishes in a restaurant, and it was very late. I was at a deserted intersection at a traffic signal, and I saw a man running, and he was dressed in, you know, regular clothes, so he wasn't a jogger. And I saw him take off an outer shirt and wrap it around something in his hand, and as he ran by this hedge, he just shoved the shirt into the hedge and kept going. And I was just curious about that, so when the light finally changed, I turned around, went over to that hedge, and pulled out the shirt, and when I unwrapped it, I found a gun. And so I put that back in. I got back in my car. I was a little bit scared by what I had just found, and but drove in the direction the man had been running, and I saw him go into a bar. So pretty soon after that, I went to a payphone. I called my dad, told him what was going on, and pretty soon police were descending on the area in their cars with flashing lights and so forth. So I knew something had happened and waved one of them down and more or less led him to where the gun was and pointed out the bar where I saw the guy who hid the gun go. And that preceded a long night with police of being taken downtown to be interviewed about what I saw, mm-hmm. to look at lineups of men that were taken from that bar. And that was about a six-hour immersion into the world of cops, and that's where my interest in crime and, first of all, reading true crime, then crime novels, the newspaper, all that, it all started on that night.
Yeah, and you said to the cops, these guys, none of these guys are the guy I saw.
Well, I mean, there's something sort of funny in it. The guy had long hair and a beard, and the bar he ran into was a kind of a notorious bar in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. It was a biker bar. So when you describe someone with long hair and a beard and he went into a biker bar, they take about everybody out of that bar because you just described them all. And so there were several lineups at the police station, and they felt confident that one of these guys was the guy I saw. But I had gotten a pretty decent look at him as he'd run under a street light, and they didn't have him. And there was a long back and forth where they thought I was intimidated by bikers or I didn't want to get involved. And they thought they had him, and I just wasn't willing to admit it or step up and do the right thing. And it was, you know, very bothersome. It's like being accused of something you didn't do.
Right, right. Well, you know, there you are, and you know, you're 16 years old.
These are, you know, a lot of them were, you know, tough detectives, rough, you know, not playing around. You know, we're not playing around, kid. Pick the guy, that type of thing. And it went back and forth until, you know, my father had been out in the waiting room, and I think he kind of sensed what was happening and kind of demanded my release, basically, even though I was a witness. I wasn't accused of anything. And so it ended on a bad note. I thought I was doing, like, a citizen-type thing, you know, helping out, trying to help solve a crime, and I ended up leaving, like, kind of with my head down, thinking I had let everybody down.
Mm. Well, doing the right thing was important to your father, including apparently standing up to authority. You want to tell us a little bit about your dad?
Well, I think the story I like to tell about my dad in regards to, you know, what I do for a living now is his unflinching support of it. He built houses, and his father built houses. So I was going to be like the son of a builder, basically, and I went off to school to learn engineering and construction and all that. And at some point, I had one of those moments, the epiphany, where I realized I did not want to do this, and I wanted to try to write some of these kind of stories that I've loved reading. And, you know, so I go home for a weekend to kind of just give the bad news, what I thought was bad news, to my parents, saying, you know, I'm already a year and a half into this major, but I'm changing it, and I'm going to pick something that is a long shot. And, you know, mostly I was telling this to my father because it was his career and I was going to follow in that. And he just really never blinked. He kind of, like, nodded and acknowledged that it was a worthy goal. And the next question is, how do you achieve that? How do you get yourself into a position that you can do that? And we kind of hatched a plan that was more hope than real strategy, but it ended up working. And
yeah.
Here I am talking to you.
Yeah. And that plan was to go to journalism school.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you know, I come home. I should say that my father had been had artistic hopes himself when he was my age. He wanted to be a painter and was actually got qualified and was in the Philadelphia Institute of Art, which was a pretty prestigious place to be, but had to drop out and go to work for his father when. He needed money for his. He got had married and started having kids, so he kind of had that unrequited artistic interest, and so that helped me when, you know, years later, his son, who was at that same age, said the same thing to him. I want to pursue something artistic, and I think he knew what he lost or what he had hoped for, and so he was fully supportive. And he said, if you want to write crime novels, you can become a cop and learn it that way, or you could, you know, possibly become a reporter and get a press pass and observe cops and get close to cops. And that was, I chose the latter. I just didn't feel I had the right temperament to be a cop.
Did you ever consider law school as a way of doing it?
Yeah, I did for a while, but I was also never a very good student, and the idea of two or three more years of school just did not appeal to me. I had a kind of a checkered history as a student, and I just wanted to get out in the world, basically.
Yeah. It seems though you do enjoy writing about lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's several lawyers in my family. When I say I was on the crime beat for 12 years, I include times on the criminal courts. I spent a couple years covering criminal courts, and so you know, the lawyer, whether it's a prosecutor or a defense attorney, they're part and parcel of the world I write about. So, yes, they are of interest to me. As my last book is kind of a testimony to that, it's really drawn out of several years of talking to some defense attorneys I know.
Yeah, The Lincoln Lawyer is the latest novel. And that's a novel that involves a lawyer, Mickey Haller. And I haven't read this yet. I'm a little behind on your books.
I'm going to slow down.
And I understand, though, is he's haunted by the fact that he might have mishandled a case.
Yeah, I mean, I think he, what's the best way of describing this? The whole story kind of came out of something a defense attorney told me once, almost in an offhand way. And he said, the scariest client I've ever had was an innocent client. And that kind of, like, made me turn my head, and I, you know, kind of like, what are you talking about? I thought all lawyers, according to all the novels and TV shows and movies we see, all lawyers cherish the innocent client because there's so few of them. And he said, but the stakes are so high that if you mess up, you live with it for the rest of your life. And I just, that was kind of a jumping off point for this book. I wanted to write about a lawyer who has that happen to him. And so it's about Mickey Haller, who is handling one case, and something about that case kind of reflects on an old case, one that's already back in archives in his warehouse, but it makes him look into it again, and he starts thinking that maybe he had mishandled it, and he starts having those regrets.
Mm-hmm. Did anything like that happen to you as a reporter, thinking, I didn't get that story quite right?
Oh, I'm sure it did several times. I mean, but, you know, there's a tendency when you're a reporter to go with the official line. You know, the authorities are the authorities. So when the police, you know, say this man is accused of something and he's been charged with this thing, you know, you kind of go for it hook, line, and sinker. And often you don't have the time or the space in the paper to exhaustively research both sides. So there's a slant towards the authoritative side, the government side. And so many was the time over the years that I did this that I would write about someone being arrested or accused of murder, and then he's either, the charges are either dropped or it goes all the way to a trial and he's found not guilty and so on and so forth. And you carry the regrets of, you know, splashing that person's name and likeness into the newspapers associated with the crime.
Mm. You know, you just talked about you know, the cops being the authority, law enforcement. And here in this collection of your work as a journalist, there is a series, actually, of stories that you include under the bigger title, Death Squad. Mm-hmm. These stories began in February 1990, and they run through the spring of 1992. Tell us about covering that story, the LAPD's Special Investigation Section.
Well, I mean, it was an ongoing controversy, and I always throw out this caveat that by far I was not the only reporter writing about this. It was almost a newspaper-wide project at the LA Times, because it was a squad of highly trained detectives who were great at following people. And there was all kinds of moral issues involved, because they would follow people suspected of pretty serious crimes, and in order to make cases against them, they would watch as crimes took place. They would not intervene. And that was the first thing that caught the eye of the newspaper and reporters. Like, is this right? It doesn't matter if they couldn't make a case. Shouldn't they stop people from being terrorized or abducted or pistol whipped, or you know, these kind of crimes were going on? And so that's why the paper paid a lot of attention to it. And it kind of blossomed into this even greater concern that not only were they letting crimes happening, but they were letting things get out of hand to the point that shootings would begin, and that they would end up shooting these criminals. And it's a very hard thing to prove or to even back up, but the idea is that the police would let things go to a point that there's no alternative but to have a shootout. And the stories in this book you're referring to all revolve around one shootout that occurred after a robbery of a McDonald's, where three robbers were killed and one was injured.
Yeah, and there was a question of whether or not they actually had, it was a case of self-defense, as the police officers said, There's a question, if I'm reading this correctly, that maybe they did more than follow these guys, watch them commit a crime, and then in self-defense shoot them. Maybe, yeah. Perhaps they well, it wasn't self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing smacked of a setup, because the what was not debatable was that these four robbers did not have real guns. And so the police statement was that we opened fire when they pointed guns at us. And so it became a common sense thing. If you were a robber and there were, and these were, this was a big troop of cops. There's usually 8 to 12 of them, and I think there were 9 at that scene that night. So if there's 9 cops jumping out of cars and lots of them have shotguns, all of them have guns, and they're yelling halt and police and all that, would you point a toy gun at that kind of threat, as the cops said? You know, and so a lot of people just did not believe that that's what happened. And so the stories in the book are about the civil suit that followed, where the survivors of the robbers sued the police, labeling this group a death squad, and they won. You know, mm-hmm. So a jury determined that they didn't. The common sense to the jury was that the robbers wouldn't have done this, and that they were set up, and that. That unit has long been disbanded because this was only one of several suits against them.
Right.
It was a very controversial time. I guess all times are controversial in the LAPD, but that was, I remember that was during the era of Rodney King, and the police department was just seemingly could not do anything right. They kept shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah. How does that affect you as a journalist covering the department?
Well, it made it more difficult because it was really a strengthening of the two entities as, you know, mortal enemies. The newspaper is an institution, and the LAPD is an institution, just hated each other. The cops, rank-and-file cops, viewed the newspapers only writing about the negative things rather than actually looking at themselves or at the department and saying, are we doing this wrong? And so it made it very hard as a ground-level reporter, as I was. I was kind of a crime du jour type of guy. I would write about the crime of the day. It was very hard to kind of penetrate this almost armed encampment. And so it made it pretty difficult. And it was, that, you know, it's part of one of the reasons why I ended up leaving when I did. I enjoyed doing both things, writing novels. I wrote my first 3.5 novels while I was working full-time on the crime beat. But it really became difficult for me to make any headway, and so eventually I said, I'll just concentrate on my novels. And the interesting thing is, once I turned in my press pass, I guess I was not seen as a threat. And so my access really improved to the police department.
Hmm. And are they? How do they feel about your novels?
Well, I would say two things. One is that if you do this all day long for a living,
mm-hmm.
the chances are you're not that interested in reading some amateur take on it. But having said that, I get very good response from the police officers who do read my books. And then again, the whole system is built so that you hear positive things as opposed to negative. Usually people don't go out of their way or go to a book signing to tell you, I hate your books. You're usually, in as far as public interaction goes, you're preaching to the choir. So when I do meet cops through, the internet or through book signings and so forth, they're usually pretty positive in their response to what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, those folks that you hear from, how do they feel about Harry Bosch?
Well, I mean, Harry's the kind of the ambassador who helps me through that door because, I don't write a great depiction of the Los Angeles Police Department as a bureaucracy, but in the middle of that chaos and fighting over all these barricades is a guy who's doing his best and I think has a kind of quiet nobility to him. And I think that's what the cops gravitate towards. So they like Harry Bosch, and so it's almost like I can say whatever I want about the LAPD, but as long as I have Harry Bosch, a good man in the center of that story, I will win over the cops.
Yeah. He's a complicated character, and he's often in trouble with his superiors. So I would imagine that that rings true, I would imagine.
Well, I think one of the reasons that I enjoy good response from the rank and file is that I think they kind of view that Harry gets away with stuff that they could never get away with.
Yeah.
You know, and I freely admit that is a conceit of the series because, you know, I had no idea when I was writing the first Harry Bosch book that there'd be even a second one, let alone now I'm on number 13. And so when you set up that kind of milieu where Harry's fighting the system, and then you repeat it for 13 times, it does reach a point where you're begging the question, could this guy really function in the police department this way? Would he last this long? And, you know, I don't really know. I kind of doubt he would. But, you know, that's I guess that's the cracks that are in the series that come from the success of the series, being able to write as many books about him as I have.
Yeah. Well, he's much more than a cop, and he's somebody that you come back to over and over again because you wonder what's happening with him. I remember thinking at one point he was about to lose his soul.
Well, and if you can get a reader thinking in those terms about a character, then you're, you know, you've kind of won the day because that shows an empathic connection between reader and your character, your protagonist, and that's, you know, that's what you're going for. That's the key to writing stories that people take to heart. You know, if I remember, I was on a book tour in France once, and this woman in very bad English, you know, stood up and started telling me at a book signing how worried she was about Harry Bosch. And, you know, it just struck me then that, you know, this woman has never been to Los Angeles and probably knows very little about American culture and society, but there's something transcendent that goes around the world about a character. And, you know, it's a mystery. It's a mysterious science as to how you put that character together. But if you can do it, if you can connect with readers on some level that goes beyond the fact that he's just trying to put together or solve a puzzle, then you've really won.
Mm. So what keeps drawing Batwoman in France back to your Harry Bosch novels and drawing me back? Is that the same thing that draws you back to writing him as a character?
Possibly so, but it's not. There's not an easy answer. I mean, there's things about Harry that I'm connected to and make me want to write about him. I mean, look at it. When I sit and I have a blank screen and it's time to write a new novel, I can come up with a new character or I can go back to someone I've already written about. And I've written about a few, but when I make that choice to go back to an established character, it seems that Harry always wins over anyone else I've written about. And I think it's just some of the qualities that are in him are ones that I would hope I have, or I think I have, that if I was in an extreme situation, as he often gets in, where the chips are down and you have to step up, that I would hope I would step up. So in a way, he's an alter ego, or hopeful alter ego. There's as I said before, there's something noble about his pursuit, about his relentlessness. At the same time, he's missing something and trying to find, you know, he's always trying to solve a crime, but he's also always trying to solve something about himself.
Hmm.
And if you can get things going on multiple layers, then I think you're going to do okay as a writer.
Writer Michael Connelly is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Connelly revisits his first career in his new book, Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers. Michael Connelly, journalist turned novelist. He was a reporter working the police beat before he became a fiction writer, and those days spent covering cops, criminals, and their victims inspired the plots and the characters of his novels, characters like Harry Bosch, who we've been talking about here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, questions about journalism, about true crime, about writing fiction. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL 333 WILL. Thinking now, when you mentioned Harry in extreme situations, there are some people in this collection of true stories from your career as a journalist, Crime Beat, who are extreme people in extreme situations. Maybe you'd tell us about David Russell Miller.
It's funny, when I do interviews about this book, people ask about him the most. And he was just a guy who had two lives, basically. And I included it in the book because I wanted the book to, in a way, be a bit autobiographical, where you could see a writer developing. But I also wanted some of the stories to be kind of the essence of the places they were set. And the book is pretty much two places, Los Angeles and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And David Miller was a guy who lived in Los Angeles and had a wife, and actually a high-profile wife, where he worked with the Chamber of Commerce and was in the newspaper and so forth. But he also had a whole other secret life that was back in Florida, where he had a wife and, I believe, a kid. And he went back and forth and was able to fool people, including his wives, by saying he was off on business and CIA. And when you boil it down to a short story, it sounds laughable, but the guy was very skilled at manipulating, and he was just good at it. And, you know, and to me, that was such a Los Angeles story, because L.A. is a place so many people go to reinvent themselves, you know, to start again, because wherever they're from is not working. And so it just seemed like a typical, or sort of a typical L.A. story, that here's this big shot in the Chamber of Commerce from the San Fernando Valley is not what people believe him to be.
Yeah. Maybe it's because every once in a while a story like this reaches us, and I think we wonder, how do you pull it off? I mean, and what is it like to be in those shoes?
On both
ends. I mean, in terms of being conned by somebody like David Miller, and then having to live that life of lies.
Well, I think from the David Miller standpoint, it usually, you can only do it for so long. You run out of string, and his story ended, you know, in murder and prison, and so he was good at it, and he was smooth. He was a smooth character, but it only lasts so long. One of the things the difference between writing books, novels, and writing newspaper stories is, the novels you can go inside, and as I like to say, you can follow the ripples. And see, like, how a crime affects a family, a neighborhood, a victim, a city even. And you can explore these things. Even though it's fiction, in a way, you can explore them and tell the truth about something. And in newspapers, you're more hampered by that. A, because of the space involved, whether you have the space, and B, access, and being able to get inside people's heads is very hard. But I know with the David Miller story, in his wake, he left so many people doubting themselves and wondering about themselves because they had believed him, because they had been, in a way, victimized by him. And that one might have been the more interesting story. But instead, as a newspaper reporter, you go with the crime that is charged and the story of David Miller.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, you know, writing novels, you get to explore the ripples. And I think it's interesting that I have now seen a number of foreign correspondents who are writing novels as a way to take the issues of the day and move beyond the daily dispatch and explore politics and geopolitics within the pages of a novel.
I've noticed that too. I mean, and I don't know whether it's because of, trying to explain the unexplainable or the difficult, you know, of covering a war and trying to make sense of it. But there is that adage that if you want to know the facts, read the paper. If you want to know the truth, then read a novel. And there is a, you know, there's a definitely a certain freedom you have with the novel. And yes, it's always going to be couched as fiction, but you can sure explain things, you can explore things, and you can, you know, give a sense of the truth. I mean, I know in my work, Harry Bosch is made up. But that portrait of this guy, Harry Bosch, I try to hang on a wall that is reality. And so I try to be as accurate about Los Angeles as I possibly can be, and I'm trying to be as accurate about the politics of the police department, of everything. I just want it to be real. I want, yes, Harry's made up, but I want people to believe that he could actually exist in this world. And so you end up doing a lot of journalism, and you end up telling a lot of truth.
Mm. As you introduce readers to the stories that are included in the collection Crime Beat, you note that one of the things that keeps journalists going is the adrenaline, the rush of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if when you turn to writing novels, even though it's something you had looked forward to, that was a goal, if when you came home at night, at the end of the day, it allowed you to come down from the adrenaline. In short, I guess, it's therapeutic.
Yeah, no, that was the word I was going to use. I mean, it's definitely, there was like a yin and yang to it. You know, there's so many pressures, as you know, in journalism of being, of accuracy, fairness, all these aspects of it that, you know, really take their toll on you. It's a high-pressure job. And those days when I was doing that, you know, and it's not a 9-to-5 job either. I was about to say when I was doing that 9-to-5, but it's long hours. But I always wrote fiction for a couple hours at the end of the night or end of the day. And that really kind of smoothed me out, and it was very helpful to me. That's why I was saying before that I could have gone on and done it for a long time doing both jobs because they seem to work together. For me, at least.
Mm. Do you miss being on the job as a journalist?
The thing I miss, and I haven't done it in 10 years and I still miss it, is the camaraderie in the newsroom aspect of it. I don't miss the actual reporting and journalism because I whatever I got from that, I get that fulfillment in what I do now because I spend time, I go out and hang out with the cops, I do ride-alongs, I have a notebook, I feel, you know, I ask questions. I act like a reporter when I'm writing these novels. But then when I'm ready to write, I go back to isolation, to what my wife calls the cave. I have like a dark writing room where I write by lamplight, and it's a very isolated existence, and there's nothing beats the camaraderie and the humor and even the noise of a newsroom. And I, you know, I'm 10 years past it, so I'm fine with it now. But initially, when I left the newsroom and was only a full-time writer, I had a really hard time with that.
Yeah, no deadline.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the years I spent as a reporter have made me good for deadlines. And generally, I have one deadline a year, and that you think that would be luxurious. But it kind of haunts you because you think, like, you know, if I let things go too long, I won't have enough time. So it seems like if a deadline's at 6 p.m. or a deadline's at the end of the year, it still has a way of working into the back of your head.
Mm. When was it that you realized the power of detail? I'm thinking here now of a story you wrote about the Fort Lauderdale Homicide Squad and Sergeant Hurt.
You know, it's hard for, I mean, I know detail is the most important thing about what I do now. But as far as, like, realizing that as a writer, like, you're talking about Sergeant Hurt and his glasses. Well, I've come to realize that might have been the most important thing I saw. And what it was is I spent a long time with this man who was in charge of the Homicide Squad. And I spent like a week fully immersed with the squad. And at the end of the week, after seeing him put his glasses in his mouth several times, I noticed a deep groove in the earpiece, and I realized he was, you know, his teeth were clenched tight when he was doing that, and it says something about his job. I understood that in that moment that I saw it, but I didn't really value it till I thought about it later and I was writing fiction, and I could see how a little moment like that could open up, you know, a big window for my reader into this person's world.
Mm-hmm. When you were a reporter, was it difficult to see someone like the sergeant and see how the work affected him and keep some emotional distance from that?
Well, I think most of the people that I dealt with were pretty good at dealing with it themselves. There was a few cases of cops that just couldn't handle it and acted out inappropriately or you know, had troubles. And I knew some of them, but for the most part, I was seemingly gravitating towards the ones that could really handle it and kind of channel their emotions into their drive. It was like their emotional. They would find ways of making a case emotionally attaching to them, and that gave them the fuel they needed to be basically relentless to see it to its end. And it's a process that is hard to describe, but if you can see that working for people, you just really admire it. And, I mean, that's what I try to take from some of the real detectives I've known over the years and put into Harry Bosch, this sense of relentlessness, this skill at being able to control your emotions, but being able to find an emotional connection to a case because you know it gets you angry or it gives you the power you need to do what has to be done.
Is that why Harry is, where last I left him, happy with cold cases, with unsolved crimes?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, he had his own cold case to solve, which he did, I think, in the fourth book, about his mother's long-forgotten murder. And so, obviously, he has a kinship to people who are forgotten. And in the book where he's assigned to the cold case, you know, he kind of gets a pep talk from the chief who says, like, you know, if you forget these victims, then you might as well forget everything. And that's like a pitch right over the plate for Harry, because his mantra is that everybody counts or nobody counts. And so here there's an archive full of people that seemingly don't count. And so he kind of sees himself as the court of last resort, or the guardian angel who's going to do what he can, even though he's so vastly outnumbered.
Hmm. The kinds of stories that you were writing as a newspaperman, the stories that you wrote for the papers, for in South Florida and in Los Angeles, that approach you took, was it a relatively new approach? What is the art and craft today of police reporting? And could I categorize what you did as literary crime reporting?
Well, I mean, if you had categorized it during the time I was doing it, I would have loved you for it. But to me, it all came down to time. I mean, I wasn't any kind of pioneer in this, but I tried to always keep in mind I was telling a story. And, you know, most of journalism is just the facts, ma'am, reporting. And definitely that seems to be all pervasive on the cop beat or the crime beat. And so when I could, I would venture off of that. And you got to remember that I did this for 12 years, and this book contains only, 44 stories. So this is like a tip of an iceberg, and the vast underneath was just the facts, ma'am type reporting. So when I got the chance, or I had the time and the space to break up, and yeah, I mean, here was this guy who had a future goal of writing novels. So I tried to move towards that by writing stuff that would be almost novelistic in approach or more literary than you normally would see on police beat.
Yeah. Well, when I think of you in this work, I also think of Edna Buchanan, and I don't know how many reporters are able to do that kind of reporting on the police beat.
It's tough, and I, you know, it's never been a career in journalism. You know, you don't. It's rare that you find someone who says, "I want to spend a career as a police reporter." It's usually a job you move on, you start at, or you do it for a few years and then you move on for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, you become jaded and cynical by what you see, just the same as with cops. And so newspapers have always had this philosophy of do it for a while and then we'll move you on to something else. So it's rare that you come across someone like Andy Buchanan who says, no, I don't want to do anything else. I'll do this and I'll do it for 25 years or however long she did it. And did it so well. I mean, it's a rarity. And, you know, I not that I'm paying as much attention to journalism as I did when I was in it, but I'm pretty sure there's been no replacement for Eddie Buchanan anywhere in this country. And she was known in every newsroom in the country. But I don't know if there's anyone else like that now.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. The day-to-day, the daily reporter doing that job day-to-day has to live with deadlines and has to live within column inches. But today we have the internet, and if you read newspapers online, you can see that there are added features. It seems, I wonder how reporters feel about that today in print. In print journalism, is that, you know, now the newspaper can be 24/7 in a sense, so the deadline is constant, but at the same time there's room for you know, additional material that you might not get into the physical paper.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I don't know. I have a very unscientific opinion based on, you know, I still have contacts with people in the business who are still reporters. And I think in many ways it was seen as a nuisance, that it's just like one more deadline,
one more.
Where you massage the facts and make it look like you came up with something new. And it does harken back to the all-day papers. I mean, one of my first jobs at the Fort Lauderdale News was, you know, rewriting for the, I think at some days they had six different editions, and sometimes there wasn't any new information, but you had to make it seem like you came up with something new. And, you know, I think maybe the internet site attached to all the newspapers these days is just another kind of like all-day newspaper.
Hmm. Lincoln Lawyer is the latest novel now available. What's coming next?
I have a Harry Bosch novel. It comes out in October, and it's called Echo Park.
Okay.
I'm just in the stages of proofing, which is kind of like the last read-through before it goes to print.
Very good. It's been nice talking with you. I want to thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Michael Connelly. His latest book is a collection of reporting pieces that he did covering cops and killers. The title, Crime Beat, A Decade of Covering Cops and Killers. The publisher is Little Brown.